Today, the future of universities and the death of humanities. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined again by Salvatore Babones from Sydney University. Hi there.
Hi, Martin. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Well, appreciate your time. And boy, there's a big conversation to be had today about universities.
Well, we were going to have a big conversation about universities. And then we got the news overnight that the federal government wants to completely reshape its funding model for the universities in response to the coronavirus revenue hits they've all taken. And this is effectively a bailout for the losses due to the loss of international students. But what a bailout. Well, while bailing out the universities, they are insisting on completely restructuring what Australians study and maybe getting rid of me in the process.
Yeah, and it's really quite annoying because my perspective on university, and I admit, I went to Oxford, I did philosophy, so I'm sort of, you know, right in the sort of the abstract end of it. But to me, university is about being taught how to think and to have the opportunity to, if you like, work the brain out, not learn specific skills. And yet it seems to me that the total focus now of the government is to tweak the university system to focus on those people with specific fields that are job ready at the end of it. So there's a fundamental philosophical question about what are universities for?
Right. Well, you're, I think, both out of country and out of date, Martin. No offense. Oxford is one thing. Our reality here in Australia is another. And the 21st century reality is very different from the 20th century reality. Both of us went to universities in the 20th century, and we went to the kinds of universities where the idea was you should just get the best education possible, and then the job market would take care of itself. Of course, increasingly, universities are seen as vocational finishing schools. Now, I don't think they very effectively do that job, but that's how it's seen. So while our education minister, Dan Tehan, who has a Bachelor of Arts from the University of Melbourne, seems to believe that the only useful degrees are in mathematics and agriculture. Yet we know statistically that the least employable occupation after the creative arts is mathematics. The latest job surveys, mathematics is dead bottom of the, you know, of everything other than the fine arts. And agriculture, while it is of course very important for Australia, is chronically unable to attract students simply because no one wants to study it. Interestingly, and so in this complete reshuffle, just to get people up to date, what the government wants to do is effectively double, more than double, up by 113%, the cost of doing a humanities, social science, or communications degree. The soft majors that people like me teach. I'm a sociologist. And to really push students towards what they consider the more vocationally ready hard sciences. So things like, they put clinical psychology in there. I'm not sure how hard a science that really is. But things like nursing, allied health, engineering, science all have reductions in their cost. Now, some of this is policy driven and absolutely necessary. For example, reducing the cost of teacher education. Well, there's a chronic shortage of teachers because, it just doesn't pay to become a teacher. And the government either has to reduce the cost of the degree or increase the pay of teachers. Now, reducing the cost of the degree, if students were rational, would have absolutely no effect because, you know, the difference of a few thousand dollars spent in their university years is irrelevant compared to the earnings difference between becoming a teacher and going into business. So it shouldn't affect students. But of course, 17 and 18 year olds are not necessarily rational. Their parents aren't necessarily rational. And these little nudges of saving a few thousand dollars on education might in fact nudge students towards careers in teaching. So from a government standpoint, that's very cost effective. But what's not cost effective is really hitting the, let's face it, everyone knows they're the softer, easier degrees. Even I, who teach them, recognize that the humanities, social sciences, communication are not tough degrees to do. Now, by making those much more expensive, the government is going to shift, well, who knows how many? I mean, does anyone out there listening know the price elasticity of demand for humanities degrees? I expect there's a lot of elasticity. A lot of students will be shifting out of those degrees. Now, here's the catch. The whole reason for this reorganization, the whole occasion, is the coronavirus crisis. The universities have been caught out by the loss of international students and the revenue that international students bring in. They've been begging for a bailout. And what they have reasonably said is that there's enormous excess demand in Australia for university places beyond what the government has been willing hitherto to subsidize. So why don't we just open up university places to allow more students to attend university, more domestic students, and then universities can recoup at least some of their international student revenue losses with new domestic students. And I think the logic of that is basically sound. But the government says that this has to be revenue neutral. Now, the only way to make it revenue neutral would be to make desirable degrees ridiculously expensive and have students stay in those degrees. Well, the government is making the desirable degrees, if you want to call them that, in the humanities ridiculously expensive, but students are not going to stay in those degrees. I mean, they're bringing the cost of the humanities up to the cost of studying law, economics, and management and commerce. Well, okay, students might be willing to pay that premium for law and commerce because those degrees are highly remunerative. They're unlikely to be willing to pay that premium for the humanities. And if there is price elasticity, that is, if students abandon the humanities in droves, well, then there goes your revenue neutrality right out the door.
Sounds like a tricky balance to try and set. And as you say, you know, you're going to see a drift, I suspect, from one area to another. But isn't there something else here? And that is, in a way, you're trying to, you know, fire at the duck while it's flying away from you. In other words, where people are now isn't necessarily where they'll be in 3 to 5 years' time when they're at the other end of the university system. You know, the world could be quite different. Demand for different types of skills could be different too. So in a way, trying to tailor it to a particular demand at this point in time looks to me to be very risky.
Well, it is short-sighted to follow on from the duck analogy. It is short-sighted, and that's because nobody can predict the future. Look, if we really believe in a market, make all degrees the same price and let students decide what they think the future will bring. And that would be, you know, one way to let the best intelligence. Now, I'm not saying that 18-year-olds are necessarily the most intelligent, but it's their own lives. They know what they want. They know what the options are. And market-based solutions would let the consumer decide which degree to go for. This kind of heavy-handed top-down manipulation really smacks of a political agenda. And, you know, why shouldn't politicians have a political agenda? But the whole idea here is really, I mean, let's be honest, is to dismantle an inconvenient group of humanities faculties who are already under pressure. I mean, the humanities and social sciences have been declining in Australia in terms of sheer enrollment numbers for the last 10 years, not just in Australia, but in the United States, Canada, UK as well. We've seen massive declines in humanities and social sciences enrollments. And when I say massive, I mean on the order of 40% over the last 10 years. Now, I don't have firm statistics on that. It depends how you look at things, but just going on my own experience and my own little place in the world, that's what we're talking about, a one-third to one-half decline in humanities enrollments. This is just pushing that already rolling stone faster down the hill. It's going to eviscerate the humanities and social sciences in Australia, with one funny exception, English. English has been exempted from this. And here you can see the politics in motion. English is going to have the lowest price of any studies in Australia, that it's right down there with math and agriculture, is going to be English at the lowest price tier. And you can see the reasoning behind the scenes. That is, politicians must have been thinking, we want to make foreign language study strategic, and it is strategic. Australia, like all English-speaking countries, has a chronic shortage of people who are qualified in foreign languages. All right. Well, what if we made Chinese cheap, but English cost three times as much? Wouldn't that look bad politically? And how do you fix that? Well, English is a language, right? So English should come down as well. So as a result, taking on that really tough challenge of, say, learning a strategic language like Arabic or Chinese is going to be subsidized at the same level as taking classes on the Victorian novel. And that's all transparently politically. There's no reason why English is a strategic major in any sense other than the political sense of not to look bad when compared to other language majors.
Mm. Well, I can tell you something from my own experience. I used to run a large consulting firm, and I used to take an intake to graduates each year. And those graduates will be from different disciplines. And what I would often find is that those from, let's say, the mathematical or IT area had no idea about the business context. So in fact, they were completely useless, right? Because they were very good at the maths or very good at what, but they didn't have the slightly more rounded skills that I needed as somebody in an entrepreneurial role inside a large organization trying to provide advice to businesses. So it was really tricky because essentially what there was a supply of people, but actually not the capability that I needed to be able to take my business forward. And I suspect that if we're not careful, that we're still going to find the same.
Well, I actually disagree with you there in that while I'm very sympathetic to liberal arts education, it's what I wish I were able to do in my own job at the University of Sydney. The fact is what you're seeing is probably a self-selection bias. That is, the kind of person who chooses to do a degree in mathematics is a different kind of person from the kind of person who chooses to study history. I doubt that the history education, the sociology education, you know, the English education, I doubt that is really broadening minds in the sense that we would like to believe because of the way we teach it. We don't teach the humanities in Australia as a liberal art. And it's not taught that way in the United States either. It hasn't been for 50 or 80 years. The old vision of the liberal arts is broadening the mind as non-specialist degrees, as things that every citizen should be exposed to. That's long gone almost everywhere in the world. Only a few super elite universities. Maybe if you go back to your old Oxford College, you'll find that's the case. I'm not sure you'll find it even there. But in most of the world, we've specialized. It's lazy teaching for academics. Why should I have to teach broad citizenship when I teach sociology, when instead I can teach my own narrow research field? And of course, my incentive structure is replicated across everyone's incentive structure, with the result that students who study history today are not studying history. That is, they're not learning lessons of history. They're studying historiography. That is, they're studying the technique and epistemology of history, which frankly doesn't broaden the mind any more than studying mathematics or statistics does. In fact, it may be even narrower. And this is a problem. I mean, anyone who's a parent of school children can see this in their own children's assignments. That is, this narrow specialization of the liberal arts has percolated all the way down to the school level, where in elementary schools, children, instead of learning about, say, ancient Egypt and hieroglyphics and all the excitement of what happened in the past, are learning how archaeologists learn about ancient Egypt. Right? So epistemology, which we think of as this advanced, graduate school sort of topic, epistemology is being pushed down into the Australian schools curriculum, never mind at the universities. So, on the one hand, I would love to save the humanities and love to save my own job. On the other hand, I've been complaining for two decades that we in the humanities and social sciences no longer take a humanistic approach to our own teaching.
Well, it's clearly quite confrontational. I was talking to somebody today who basically is already out of a job, very senior position, but the academic community is already under pressure, jobs are already going, right? And this will presumably have more of the same, won't it?
Well, one of the big problems here in this big shift the government is promoting is that the areas that have been hit by declining international student enrollments, fundamentally business, but also communications, which has a very large Chinese student cohort, are the areas that are going to have the prices raised and fewer domestic students. So while the government's opening more domestic places, those domestic places are going to go to teaching areas that don't have the excess capacity. Meanwhile, the teaching areas that do have excess capacity, you know, especially business economics, which have lost, you know, anywhere up to 80% of their students in some cases, those fields are going to have excess staff. And frankly, you can't simply reallocate an economist to teaching agriculture. You probably could reallocate the economist to teaching math, but the university won't do it because we are highly siloed. If you think of me personally, I teach social statistics, and I could very well teach social statistics inside a revamped mathematics curriculum. But the way universities work, I wouldn't be redeployed to doing that. If the mathematics department wants to teach social statistics, they'll hire their own statistician to do it. They won't transfer me into that role. As a result, I become redundant, and there's a bonanza for staff in fields that, you know, all of a sudden will need to increase staff levels. I mean, if we believe in price signals, if you cut the price of education in a few select fields by 50% while raising prices by 100% in other areas, that is, there's a net 4-to-1 shift in the cost of education across fields, students are going to shift. And unfortunately, for people like me, 50-year-old academics are not able to switch from teaching one field to teaching another.
Yeah, it's certainly highly disruptive. One other question, which sort of is tangential but quite significant, is, of course, there is now this plan to capture some foreign students in Singapore and then bring them down to Australia and try and...
Yeah.
So, in other words, another backdoor game. Is that likely to fly, literally?
Well, it may fly, but it won't fly very much. We're talking trickles of students. These are demonstration projects. And for people who haven't been following it, each state has been allowed to present a plan for bringing international students in if it desires. I know that South Australia and ACT have already announced plans, but they're very small numbers. I believe South Australia is 750 and ACT is 350, something along those lines. They're very small numbers of students involved. That is a drop in the ocean of international students. And in fact, priority will be given, as it should be, to currently enrolled students. So students who are already, or not currently enrolled, but currently matriculated students. So students who are already in degree programs. Mm. We're not going to see new enrollments coming in through these mechanisms. So even if they work, they're small numbers of students, they're already enrolled. And let's face it, already enrolled students have a strong incentive just to take the online offerings being offered in place of in-person study. Of course, we might lose some who aren't willing to pay for the online offering, but if you've already done 2 out of 3 years of a degree, well, are you going to abandon it or are you going to take the online class and grumble about it? I think students will take the online class and grumble about it. The real fiscal challenge for Australian universities is new international enrollments, which of course have come to a dead stop. And these experimental openings are not focusing on bringing in new international enrollment. So the real question there will become February. Do we have a new entering class of undergraduates and crucially master's students in fields like master's in management and master's in economics, or don't we? And frankly, I think larger forces are going to mean that we don't. And those larger forces, first and foremost, are the Chinese government's incentive to use the coronavirus as an opportunity to staunch the flow of students going out of the country to study overseas.
Mm. Yeah, and of course there's a little bit of PR or whatever you want to call it in terms of suggesting that maybe students from China coming to Australia might get bullied.
Right. Well, there are three strong reasons why China will, and here I'm just going to go out on a limb and tell you, will stop new commencements at universities in Australia, North America, and the UK. The first is the Chinese universities need the students. China, of course, has had a one-child policy, for 3 decades. And as a result, the cohorts of new graduating high school students, those cohorts are going to be declining throughout the 2020s. Now, counterintuitively, they were rising throughout the 2010s. And the reason was a Chinese baby boom that followed the Great Famine in the 1950s. So in the 1960s and early 70s, there was a baby boom in China. One child policy came into effect. But the children of those Chinese baby boomers are the baby boomlet that has been graduating high school up until 2020. That generation is falling off a cliff because of the one-child policy that was implemented in a soft way in the late 1970s and in a hard way in 1982. So now we're seeing smaller and smaller cohorts of Chinese students entering universities. The Chinese government is already closing down Chinese universities because of a lack of projected lack of students for them. They need to keep students at home, and 700,000 students studying overseas is a lot of students who can be redirected to Chinese universities. Reason number two is money. The Chinese yuan has been under pressure. Last year, it broke through that magic number of 7 yuan per dollar. It's now below 7.1. In the crazy terminology of the foreign exchange world, it is below 7.1 per dollar. That is, the yuan is getting weaker and weaker vis-a-vis the U.S. dollar. And China has had for all Donald Trump may want to accuse him of currency manipulation, they've been manipulating their currency stronger. They haven't been manipulating it weaker to get trade advantages. They've been manipulating it stronger in an attempt to keep up the purchasing power of the yuan and for prestige purposes and to maintain the international purchasing power of the yuan. There have been lots of reasons why they've wanted a strong yuan. Well, to keep that yuan strong, the Chinese government has had to impose stricter and stricter capital controls over the last 5 years. And the next thing in their crosshairs, I'm certain, is the money that is leaking out of the system through international students. Now, the actual amount of money going out for tuition is probably not that important to China. That is, tuition payments that Chinese apply. I mean, Chinese families literally have to go to the bank and apply to get money to pay tuition when they want to pay Australian tuition. They can't just take money out of their account and spend it. They have to go to the bank, show the admissions records, show the bill from the Australian university, and get a special draft to pay the bill. That is going to get harder and harder, but that's probably globally costing China something like 50 billion Australian dollars a year. Large, but not extreme. The real problem for China is that once students are overseas, they become conduits for capital flight. Because, of course, a student in Australia can open an Australian bank account. That, again, makes it easier to move money. Can buy property in Australia. That makes it easier to move money. I mean, once they have a student in Australia or in any other foreign country, it facilitates capital flight that is otherwise very difficult. I mean, in theory, every Chinese family, every Chinese individual can move 50,000 US dollars out of the country every year, in theory. In practice, it's virtually impossible without these sort of tools that international students provide. So closing down international education for China has the second big advantage. It staunches the flow of foreign capital out of the country. And then, of course, third is what you just mentioned, the propaganda victory. If China can declare that the rest of the world is not creating a safe environment and Chinese students can only safely be educated at home, well, that's a propaganda victory for China. And that propaganda victory, I think, will probably be well-earned when it comes to the UK and US. I mean, let's face it, the UK and US do have endemic coronavirus problems, much worse than what China's seems to be right now. Australia seems to have defeated the coronavirus, so that excuse won't hold with Australia. But instead, we've seen this, well, Australia's a racist country. And of course, accusations of racism are routinely flung at the United States and less so Canada and the United Kingdom by China. It's a propaganda victory to keep the students home, to keep them safe. So on all three counts, China needs the students, China needs the money, China wants propaganda victory. I really think new commencements of Chinese students in 2021 are very unlikely.
All right. So if you take that on board and also the government announcements today, what does that mean for the bottom line of the universities?
Well, the universities are going to lose money, and especially the group of eight universities plus UTS. UTS is the one non-group of eight university that's also highly exposed to Chinese and international students. Other Australian universities are also exposed. I mean, we forget that because the exposure is so enormous in the group of eight that we forget that even places like, University of Central Queensland would be among the most internationalized universities in North America if they were there. But by Australian standards, these regional universities like Charles Sturt, UCQ, USQ, are not so exposed. Doesn't mean they don't have financial problems. It means their financial problems are not as extreme as the big group of eight universities. That the group of eight universities have spent the last 20 years really redirecting international student money into big ticket research projects that have fueled their march up the rankings, up the international research rankings. And that's why we have so many highly ranked universities in Australia. Now, Michael Spence, my own vice chancellor at the University of Sydney, has been very frank about this. Others have, I think, tried to muddy the waters a bit. But the money from international students has been poured directly into research. And Michael Spence has highlighted that by saying that if Australia doesn't pick up the tab for research, Australia will lose its massive research infrastructure. And frankly, I think he's right about that. Australia will lose a lot of its research infrastructure. The question for Australia is, does it want that research infrastructure? I mean, I love publishing sociology papers, but I'm not sure that it does much for Australia that I publish sociology papers. Now, we always hear other things like, oh, but it's important, we're going to cure cancer. Well, I think it's important to cure cancer. Is it important for Australia to cure cancer? Well, that's much more of a, you know, a commons problem. Should Australia leave it to the US and UK to cure cancer and just free ride on the cancer cures that arise from it? That's a question for Australian taxpayers. Do Australians want to be doing basic research that is not going to be commercialized in any, at any level to support itself? I mean, if this research were actually being commercialized at a level that it could support itself, there will be no need to subsidize it with student payments. Mm-hmm. Now, if I were redesigning Australia's university system, I would try to make a, if not ironclad, at least a very firm firewall between the education mission and any additional research mission universities wanted to undertake. And with that plan, I would say that student tuition should fund people who are teaching students. So if you take someone like me, I do research, but my salary is paid for by students. I teach classes, and with the kind of with the extra premiums that we get from teaching, is we don't put all of our teaching receipts back into teaching. That's enough to support my research. Now, supporting my research basically means give me a little bit of time off to do research and occasionally send me to a conference. That kind of model can support a modest level of ordinary academic research. The problem is it can't support massive research institutes that are dedicated, that are staffed with dedicated researchers who don't do any teaching. Now, what I'd like to see in Australia is a model where revenues from teaching support teaching and research faculty. I don't think universities should stop doing research. I think it's very valuable that university students are exposed to people who are active researchers, who are deep in the nitty-gritty of their fields, who are, you know, real experts with the kind of expertise that only comes from doing research yourself. But that students should be exposed to that. If the university wants to have people who are research only, who are not interacting with students, I don't think those people should be supported by student fee income, whether domestic or international. Now, that's our fundamental fiscal challenge at places like University of Sydney, UNSW, University of Melbourne, UQ. All of these major research universities have been funding research-only faculty out of tuition, primarily the tuition of international students. That model is not sustainable. And what people like Michael Spence have said is either the government has to pick up the tab for that research or see tens of thousands of researchers lose their jobs. Now, I think he's right about that. Our difference is which should be done. As a taxpayer, I don't want to support university researchers just because it's a noble thing to do. As a taxpayer, I would like to see my money going to what I think are more important causes. Michael Spence, of course, believes that the best way Australian taxpayers can spend their money is supporting university research. And that's a legitimate difference of opinion.
Yeah, and I can see there that the argument's on both sides. But flip it around. If I was thinking of going to university and I was, you know, 18 or 19 now, conscious that I'm going to have to incur debts to do it, conscious that I'm probably going to have to pick a course that is more aligned to capability rather than actually, you know, academic endeavor overall, Is that a more or less attractive proposition than, let's say, 5, 10, 15 years ago, do you think?
Well, first of all, I want to remind you, no Australian student has to incur debts. They have to take on future tax liabilities. Australians, the Australian government and Australians have pushed this idea that HECS is a debt. HECS is not a debt. I mean, I have American student loans. That's a debt. That is, I pay a set interest rate, you know, fixed rate interest rate from money I borrowed when I was at university. I've paid that ever since I graduated. I had a 6-month grace period after graduation, from which point I started paying debt. I had the option to capitalize the interest early on and then pay more later. And I did that. So I paid lower payments early on. I pay larger payments now that I'm 50 years old. But when I capitalized the interest, I had to pay interest on the interest that I put back into the loan. So it's a true loan. I'm paying whatever I received plus interest. In Australia, it's effectively a tax on university graduates that is only paid when those graduates reach an income threshold that is above the median income in Australia. Now, I think that's the fairest higher education funding system in the world. And my recommendation to Australia would be to completely get rid of the government subsidy for degrees. Instead of arguing about which degree should get a subsidy and which shouldn't, get rid of the subsidies, just put everything into HECS, because HECS is not a debt. HECS is an extraordinarily fair, extraordinarily well-designed taxation system that taxes those who benefit from a university education only if they benefit. And if you get that art degree and you spend your life as a starving artist, you will never have to pay for your university education, right? So to me, that's eminently fair. It's eminently responsible. And in that kind of system, if you think of it that way as a tax system, then of course students decide, does a university education make sense for me? Do I want to pay taxes in the future in order to get a degree? And then we start to view it more as a lifestyle decision. Well, you know, you might enjoy your 3 or 4 years at a university. We can afford to go back to the liberal arts model where students dabble, where they do a little of this and that, where, you know, they simply use that 3 or 4 years to think about life and mature and grow as individuals. The fact is that whether you study science or history, either way, the knowledge you get is not going to be useful. If you think about it, what use is the science knowledge that you would have gained if you had done a biology degree? I'm going to be generous, Martin, 20 years ago, you had done a biology degree. Would that knowledge still be useful? No, you would have learned as an undergraduate biology student, 20-year-old biology, because undergraduates don't get the cutting edge. And now you would be 20 years late. Your knowledge of biology would now be 40, 50 years out of date. Okay, so this kind of myth that when you study the sciences, you're getting something that is going to be useful to you in life, well, it's just a myth. Now, what is useful? Things like programming classes, which are done outside of universities typically, learning foreign language, which you can do outside of a university, professional certifications, which you can do outside a university. I mean, it just so happens that accounting certifications are done inside the university system, but the certification program could probably more effectively be run outside the university system. I mean, why should a certified financial advisor be a non-university degree, but a certified public accountant is a university degree? Well, that's purely for historical reasons. My own preference would be to take these kind of professional certifications, just take them out of the university system entirely. Even learning to be a teacher. I mean, it's the best way to teach teachers, to put them through a 3 or 4 year teacher education program. Or will we be better off, as many US states do now, will we be better off having students study the subject area they're interested in? That is, you want to be a history teacher, study history, and then do a 1 year certification program after you finish your history degree because you want to be a history teacher. That is, shouldn't we separate the technology of learning how to classroom teach from the knowledge base that you're going to teach in the classroom? And that basic principle could be applied in all sorts of places. Clinical psychology, again, well, do a psych major as a undergraduate student, but then if you want to become a clinical psychologist, do a 1 year professional training program. So I would like to see those functions separated. In our current world, where those functions are mingled for historical reasons in some fields but not in others, well, the assumption underlying your question is absolutely correct. A university degree may not be worth it financially. There may be no reason to do a university degree, depending what field you want to get into. I mean, firms like accounting firms, or you mentioned consulting firms. With your consulting firm, you probably hired mainly new graduates. Was that because you needed the knowledge base they learned in their undergraduate degrees? You know, I suspect not. It's probably just because you're looking for the best 22-year-olds in the country, and where you're going to find them, you're going to find them coming out of Sydney, Melbourne, and UQ and ANU undergraduate honors programs. And so that's where you go to look for them.
Well, that's right. I mean, it was the idea. I think whether it worked or not is debatable. The idea was you had people who were brighter, therefore more able to take on new skills and to be molded into somebody who could be productive in the context of management consulting. In theory, in practice, boy, it was a hit and miss. So,
well, of course, but look at firms like Goldman Sachs. You know, top American investment banks like J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs. They don't hire finance grads; they hire Harvard grads. And what they're looking for are simply the best students. What Harvard provides for them is a selection mechanism. That is, Harvard finds what they believe are the best students and feed them to these firms that then hire Harvard, Yale, and Stanford grads. It's not that they value what they learned at those universities. It's they value the selection being done by those universities, which raises a whole nother program for another time. If we get rid of testing, as many people in the Black Lives Matters movement are demanding, well, then will these universities still perform that sorting function? And if they don't, will firms still value a university degree? Well, Martin, that's another show.
Yeah, I think we probably should pick that up and look at it, because I think that in itself is a very, very interesting conversation. And again, I got some experience personally and also from my wife, who's a university professor, in terms of how she perceives the testing processes. So we'll come back to that. But look, I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much for sharing your perspectives. And it's clearly a traumatic time for many people in the university sector. So I hope you keep your job and hope you keep the enthusiasm that you have in terms of what you do.
Well, anyone who's looking for a freelance intellectual, give me a call. I'll be free next year.
Thanks. Good to talk to you.
Bye-bye.